in order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood. From my heart, I take refuge in the Three Jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood. From my heart, I take refuge in the Three Jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood. From my heart, I take refuge in the Three Jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all our steps in the path of omniscience, may these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. Om Manjushri, please accomplish this. Okay, so first the text, and then we'll look at the handouts, and the text begins on page 188, I believe. I'm wrong. Is it 203? Yeah. 203, right? Everybody have the reading for tonight? I wonder if I have the PDF. I don't think I do. Oh, there it is, yeah. So, 203. Okay. Anybody need that reading? PDF 203.
I'm sorry. I'm confused about what we're.
No problem. Let me circulate that.
I thought we finished the book last time.
Yeah, we're talking about a reading that he sent by email that's entitled One and Four Paths from...
Oh, well, yes, I have that, yeah. Okay.
Anyone else need it?
Kevin, are you saying something?
Yes, Derek, I could use it. I didn't print it out. So
you got it. Here it is. I sent it. How fast is it? Hast thou received it? The speed of light. Anybody else get that email?
Let me see. It usually takes a couple of minutes for things to get through the airwaves.
I got it. But I'm closest.
That's different.
But it does have to go to the server and come back to me.
Wait, if you send it. Yeah. Yes, it came 0 minutes ago at 8 o'clock.
My clock says 7:59, so that's in the future. That clock is wrong. Okay, assertions on the path. We're in the Great Exposition School. Anyone know the Sanskrit for that? Which school that might be?
Vaishika.
All right. Morgan nailed it. Yeah, Vaibhashika. And so Great Exposition is a translation of the text that they base their school on called the Mahavibhasha, which is supposedly this huge compilation of all sorts of material. And it would be really neat if somebody would translate even a slimmer section of it someday. I've never found anything. Anyway. It's the first of the Buddhist schools in this text, which, by the way, is a wonderful presentation of tenets. It's in a book called Cutting Through Appearances, Practice and Theory of Tibetan Buddhism, and it begins with practice. I don't know if I didn't give the table of contents from the book, but it has a text by the fourth Panchen Lama, his commentary on the three principal aspects of the path, which is a famous text by Tsongkhapa, the establisher, grandfather of the Gelugpa tradition. And the three principal aspects are renunciation, emptiness, and compassion. Or bodhicitta. That's the second aspect, and then the emptiness, the view of emptiness. It has a nice little presentation of how to meditate on emptiness. And then there's this text, which is called the Precious Garland of Tenets by Gongchuk Jigme Wangpo. And it's a condensation of a large text by Jamyang Shepa. To masters of the Gelugpa tradition of tenet texts. And this one is very good. It also has commentary, I think what we call interlinear commentary by Geshe Lunjup Sopa. Possibly with Jeffrey Hopkins too. Is that right? Okay, so page 203 of that is the first Buddhist school, the Vaibhashika school, assertions on the paths. This section has three parts, the great exposition school's assertion regarding the objects of observation on the paths, like what do we focus on while we're on the paths? What are those objects that are abandoned by the paths? And then the nature of the paths. I think he uses the same standardized format for each school. And I selected two schools, this first one, the two largest presentations of the path from the options in this text, which happen to be the Vaibhashika tradition and then the Yogacara Svatantrika. Objects of observation in the past. The objects of observation are the 16 attributes of the four truths, impermanence, and so on. There's four attributes to each of the four truths. The first one is true sufferings. It's the first truth. And the aspects are impermanence, misery, emptiness, and selflessness. And I sent you a little handout on that somewhere. Moments. Here we go. Impermanence, origin, cessation of or disappearance, and path. That's interesting. Quite different. Impermanence, misery, emptiness, and selflessness. That's a very interesting difference. Okay. So let's go with the text version. Attributes of the second true origins or cause origin. Strong production and condition. So four aspects of each of the four noble truths, and these are the objects of observation on this on the Vaibhashika path. The basic object of observation is the four noble truths, and the detail of that is these 16 aspects, four for each. Attributes of the third true cessations or cessation, and they usually repeat the truths in the sub. Aspects. So we saw in the first one there was suffering, misery. In the second one there was origin. The third one is cessation, pacification, auspiciousness. Interesting. And definite emergence from a portion of the obstructions, cessation. Attributes of the fourth are path, suitability, achievement, and deliverance. The movie. Subtle selflessness and subtle selflessness of the person are asserted to be mutually inclusive. What the hell does that mean? They're mutually inclusive.
Does that mean they're equal?
They're synonymous. Yeah. Synonymous, what's the implication of saying that these two are synonymous? Why say that? There's a hint in the little inserted commentary.
Oh, because they're saying they're not distinguishing phenomena?
Yes! Trying to get a little blood flowing here. Yeah, so in the Vaibhashika tradition, they don't have a selflessness of phenomena. So if you're going to talk about subtle selflessness, it necessarily means subtle selflessness of persons. Because they don't think that phenomena are selfless. They think that phenomena are real. They hold dharmas to be real, dharmas, phenomena to be real. The subtle selflessness of persons, so I skipped the quote, is asserted to be a person's emptiness of being substantially existent in the sense of being self-sufficient. So in other words, the person, a person's self is not self-sufficient in that you need the attributes of that person to be present in order to project the idea of a self onto them. And by attributes, I mean the five skandhas. So without the five skandhas, you can't project the idea of a person onto a onto space. So they're not, the person is not self-sufficient. Person is dependent completely upon the five skandhas and does not have a self-sufficient status. Let's see. From among the 18 schools, sub-schools of the Vaibhashika school, the five Samatiya sub-schools do not assert that a person's emptiness of being substantially existent in the sense of being self-sufficient is the subtle selflessness, because they consider that a substantially existent or self-sufficient person exists. So there are some that claim to be Buddhists who assert that there is a substantially existent or self-sufficient person separate from the skandhas. Isn't that bizarre? It's an incomprehensible person. Most people are incomprehensible anyway, but
why do they accept them as being classified as Buddhist?
Yeah, because they meet the criteria in all other aspects, and they're a little bit slippery on the way they're basically saying, just like somehow there has to be some place to hang the karma, the condensation of karma. And they just call it the person. And then they say, well, when you ask them, well, what is that person? How does it relate to the skandhas? They say, I don't know. And that's called the, they have a term for it, like indefinable or something like that. I can't remember.
So basically that whole thing of holding the karma is, it sort of persists as a problem all the way through. And everybody comes up with some, and well, some of them come up with a specific place for it. In this case, the person, later on, Thealaya Vijnana, and then the Madhyamakas say no dice. But yet they still say things persist in terms of karma. So they just don't name something so that they can't be attacked.
Disintegration. They say karma adheres to disintegration.
Right, but I'm not quite ready to understand that as any.
Yeah. But the main point is what you concluded there, which is, thank you for doing that. I wanted to try to highlight that in our concluding classes. Like, we go through all this complexity of all these views, and basically it boils down to each different school trying to answer, like, a few basic questions of, like, how does karma adhere? What is it adhere to? And if there's no self, then what? And where are you going to stick it? And what is delusion? And what is enlightenment? And now we get into how to achieve enlightenment. But,
and there's also what is real, right?
Yeah, well, that's the framework. It's like, what is real? What are the objects of knowledge? How do we know it? What are the different ways of knowing?
Right.
And then, if you remember the Natarta chart, there was the classification of phenomena in terms of entity. And then the classification terminologically in terms of activity, cause and effect. So that's karma. You know, so basically there's things and what they do, how they function. It boils down to. And the main functions are karma.
I see another chart coming on somehow.
Well, that chart sort of does it, but yeah, maybe one that sort of summarizes it in that way. Anyway,
Across all the schools, does it do that one? That or
yeah, so that's a big one, you know. And then the other one is like, how does perception happen? And we'll see that. I can't remember if we see that tonight, but like, you know, does the eye contact the object directly, or is there an aspect, right? So how does that happen? Is there self-awareness, karma, perception?
so does this table exist somewhere already? Have you seen something like this? It seems like it's a
No.
obvious thing to, you
That
know.
would be a good table. Yeah. How do the views on these core topics
Yeah, I think that's
differ in the
a good
tradition? How
project.
that would be great. I would be happy to help you with it.
In our spare
Especially
time.
if you take the lead on it. Yeah. Okay, so the proponents of the Great Exposition do not assert a presentation of coarse and subtle selflessness of phenomena because they hold that all established bases, such as mind, body, house, and so on, have a self, a phenomena. That is, they truly exist and have a difference of entity, of subject and object. They exist from their own side, and they are self-sufficient, and they're substantially existent in the sense of being self-sufficient, right? All that fun language, i.e., real, as Cynthia just said. When the proponents of the Great Exposition speak of a subtle self of persons, they mean a person that is seen as having a character different from the mental and physical aggregates. This definition of self applies only to persons because phenomena are not conceived this way. Therefore, within the context of their own perspective, it is possible for the proponents of the Great Exposition to maintain the existence of a self of phenomena, such as their true existence, and to deny the existence of a self of persons. Objects abandoned by the path. There are two types of ignorance to be abandoned through the path: afflictive and non-afflictive ignorance. The first, afflictive ignorance, mainly prevents the attainment of liberation. So there's a distinction between liberation and omniscience. Liberation is the freedom from samsara, and omniscience is the state of Buddhahood. Illustrations of afflictive ignorance are consciousness conceiving itself of persons and the three poisons which arise on account of this misconception. I added miss, as well as their needs, seeds. Sorry. Non-afflictive ignorance mainly prevents the attainment of all not knowingness. Illustrations of non-afflictive ignorance are the four causes of non-knowingness, such as the non-afflictive obstruction, that is, the ignorance of the profound and subtle qualities of a Buddha. The other three causes of non-knowingness are ignorance due to the distant place of an object, ignorance due to the distant time of an object, and ignorance due to the nature of the object, such as the subtle details of the relationship of karmic causes with their effects. So these are all things that apparently only Buddhists can know, things that are at the end of the universe, things that happened at the beginning or end of the universe, long time ago or in the future, and then the intricacies of the workings of karma is the most famous example of something that only a Buddha can know in all its details. The all-knowingness mentioned here is not a Buddhist quality of omniscience, as it is understood in the great vehicles, tenet systems. All-knowingness here simply means that if a Buddha thinks about objects seen or unseen, a Buddha will know those things one by one as she or he thinks about them. The great vehicle tenet systems, however, assert that a Buddha can know all things simultaneously and instantly, without exerting any effort of thought. The proponents of the Great Exposition do not accept such omniscience, and therefore they do not assert obstructions to omniscience. They merely distinguish between afflictive and non-afflictive ignorance. The great vehicle systems distinguish between an ignorance as an afflictive obstruction rather, and a non-afflictive ignorance that is an obstruction to omniscience. With respect to the obstructions, aside from obstructions to liberation and non-afflictive ignorance, the proponents of the Great Exposition do not accept the designation obstructions to omniscience. Cynthia?
Didn't Trungpa Rinpoche talk about omniscience like in a way of like saying it's not like as sort of vast or broad. I don't remember exactly the details, but do you remember him?
I don't. It'd be great if we could find a place where he describes it.
Somehow I thought there was some quality that he was slightly debunking people's like over
Yeah,
broad.
that does sound familiar. So that's he, it sounds like he was more aligning himself with the Great Exposition School's version.
A little bit, although I again, I'm this was just kind of it's a recollection I have, and I don't know if I could find where it's from. I guess we'd have
Yeah,
to.
I wonder if it's in the second volume where he goes through the Bhumis and Buddhahood of the Profound Treasury. Okay, so thirdly, the nature of the path. With respect to the paths of the three vehicles, Shravaka, Pratyekabuddha, and Bodhisattva, here referred to respectively as here, solitary realizer, and Bodhisattva, they assert a presentation of the five paths: accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and no more learning. And however, they do not, and you see in the footnotes the Sanskrit for that, for those, as well as the Tibetan. However, they do not accept the exalted wisdoms of the 10 Bodhisattva grounds. They assert that the first 15 of the 16 moments of forbearance and knowledge, which constitute the path of seeing, constitute the path of seeing, and that the 16th moment of the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, or the six, the, you know, we just went through 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, but there's also 16 moments of realizing the Four Noble Truths, and they're not actually the same 16. They're slightly nuanced, let's say. But anyway, for now, we have the 16th moment of the 16, which is called subsequent knowledge of the path, is the beginning of the path of meditation, the fourth path. So those 16 in this system span two paths. See the chart next page. So maybe we'll take a quick look at their chart. 16 moments of forbearance and knowledge. So if we start at the bottom, as this chart rather does, at the bottom we have the path of seeing, approacher to the fruit of stream entry. So a person who is on the path of seeing is called an approacher to the fruit of stream entry, because the path of seeing leads to the obtainment or the abiding in the state of stream entry, which is the first of four stages of arhatship. And it begins with let's see, on the right-hand side, true suffering. So we have the four truths going upwards, suffering, origin, cessation paths. And then we have for each of those, we have a segmentation into desire realm and the higher realms, being the form and formless. Altogether nine realms. There's one desire realm, and then there's four form realms and four formless realms. Altogether nine realms. And those are repeated for each of the four truths. And then within each one, we have a forbearance and then a knowledge in the desire realm, and then a subsequent forbearance and a subsequent knowledge. And that scheme of four stages of understanding suffering in terms of the desire realm, and then in terms of the higher realms, in as a subsequent, what's called subsequent, repeats itself for the Four Noble Truths. And so, what does this all mean? It's my really vague understanding of it is that in order to enter into the true understanding of the truth of true sufferings, one has to exhibit the quality of forbearance or patience that sort of stays with the truth in order to experience it fully. And then at a certain point, one understands it fully and has the knowledge of that truth in terms of the desire realm. And then one then, if one then continues in one's application of the three wheels, presumably, or the three higher trainings, Shila, Samadhi, Prajna, or absorption meditation, as the case would be more likely in this tradition, one experiences subsequent forbearance, patience, forbearance being another translation of patience, and then subsequent knowledge, being the application of true suffering to the higher realms, it's understanding that even the higher realms are pervaded by suffering. The all-pervading suffering pervades all. And then one would do the same in terms of understanding the origin of suffering, the cessation and the path. So that's the basic scheme. And hello, Kaylin, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Great to see you. Let's see. So we were seeing the chart on the next page. So we go back to page 207. The path of seeing is the time when direct cognition of the Four Noble Truths first occurs. The paths of forbearance are so called because one develops facility or non-fear with respect to the object of meditation. They're also called uninterrupted paths because they lead without interruption into paths of release in the same meditative session. Paths of release. Paths of release are the paths of knowledge or the knowledge that certain afflictive emotions have been abandoned. So these terms, path of release, path of knowledge, are unclear exactly what those are, paths of knowledge. Let's see if the reading clarifies them as we go on. They assert that the generation of these 16 moments occurs no other way than serially, one step at a time, like a goat walking over a bridge. Just what you would have said as the example for serially, maybe as like a escalator. But they didn't have escalators. They envision the process in this way. The Four Noble Truths of the object contemplate in the path of seeing for each truth. There's a forbearance and a path of knowledge in relation to the desire realm. So that's what the path of, they're saying, path of knowledge is the second stage, forbearance and then knowledge. So they would say there's a path of forbearance and a path of knowledge. And the paths of knowledge are paths of release. Okay. There's also a path of subsequent forbearance and a path of subsequent knowledge in relation to higher realms, form and formless, which are included in one category. And when meditators complete the paths of the first truth in relation to the desire realm, they then pass to the paths of the first truth in relation to the form and formless realms. The 16th moment is the time of entering the path of meditation. Other schools say that the 8 forbearances can occur simultaneously and that the 8 knowledges can occur simultaneously. So there's 2 moments to the 16 stages of the full knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. True paths are not necessarily consciousnesses. This is such a weird statement. Because the proponents of the Great Exposition maintain that the 5 uncontaminated mental and physical aggregates are true paths, which is one of the more interesting statements, because not the part about them being consciousness, but the part about them acknowledging the existence of uncontaminated aggregates, right? So the insert, which is, I guess, the commentary, says, except for the Great Exposition School and the Sutra School following Scripture. So the Sutra School following Scripture would be the Sautrantikas based on Sutra. The Sutra Sautrantikas, all schools assert that true paths are consciousnesses. The proponents of the Great Exposition Exorcism School include within true paths the 5 mental and physical aggregates at, for example, the time of the 15th moment of the path of seeing. However, it is not the case that every instance of the 5 aggregates included within a superior's continuum is a true path, and hence uncontaminated. Uh, It is not, however, it's not the case that every instance of the five aggregates included within a superior's continuum. So the term superior, by definition, is one who has achieved the path of seeing or above. So that would start at the first moment of the 15 moments of the path of seeing. The point is that there are instances of each of the aggregates that are true paths and thus uncontaminated. These uncontaminated phenomena, moments of awareness, are phenomena, right? Remember that term, phenomena, applies to moments of awareness. So consciousness and consciousnesses are phenomena, and they exist in moments. Illustrations. These uncontaminated phenomena are those associated with the superior's uncontaminated path. Illustrations are a superior's mental consciousness, the accompanying mental factors of feeling and discrimination. So on the path of seeing, we still have the five aggregates. We have feeling, discrimination, consciousness. And one would have mind moments that consist of a prime consciousness and mental factors from among the 46 or however many mental factors they have in this tradition. The subtle forms which restrain certain faults and which naturally arise whenever a superior is in meditative equipoise in an uncontaminated path, and the predispositions established by these paths are all examples of superior's are all examples of uncontaminated phenomena associated with a superior's uncontaminated path. All these are uncontaminated objects and are true paths. So it's a weird way of talking about things. But all those aspects of a superior's continuum of aggregates at the time of being on the path of seeing and above are true paths. And true paths are paths that I believe it's synonymous with uninterrupted, and that they lead towards the next higher path, as opposed to untrue paths don't necessarily lead that way. Assertions about the fruits of the path, those of the hero lineage, Shravakas, become familiar with the 16 attributes of those four noble truths, impermanence and so forth, over the course of three lifetimes or more, by relying on the Vajra-like meditative stabilization, known in our tradition as the Vajra-like Samadhi, on the hearer Shravaka path of meditation, they finally abandon the afflictive obscure obstructions by ceasing their obtaining causes. So their obtainment is accomplished by ceasing their obtaining causes, which are the potentialities that cause one to have the afflictive emotions. So there's a little gloss and commentary on a Vajra, which we know about. It's able to overcome the final object of abandonment. Then they manifest the fruit of becoming a foe destroyer. Sounds like a football team, like a college football team. The foe destroyers. That's the translation in this tradition of in the school of Jeffrey Hopkins. That's the translation of which term? Hat, arhat, 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 foe destroyer, destroy your foes on the great path of accumulation and below. What does that mean, the great path of accumulation and below? It means on the small and medium path of accumulation. So the path of accumulation has three stages, and they're arranged hierarchically. So the greater path of accumulation is higher than the middle, and the middle is higher than the lower. So on the great path of accumulation and below, in other words, the entire path of accumulation, rhinoceros-like solitary realizers, shravakas who have a big horn of a nose, like a rhinoceros, meaning ones who prefer to live alone. They have this idea that rhinoceroses are solitary creatures and don't aggregate. And so there's this idea that there's shravakas who, sorry, pratika buddhas, solitary realizers, sorry, hearers are shravakas. Pratika buddhas, there's a, the main type of pratika buddhas are those who stay alone, stay away from people. People are a problem, as we know. Stay away from them. They practice the realization that the person is empty of substantial existence in the sense of being self-sufficient. So hopefully that clunky phrase has some meaning at this point. Something that's self-sufficient is not dependent on anything else for its being observed, for its being named, for its being identified. It's not dependent on its basis of designation. It has its own, it exists from its own side, from its back side or front side or whatever side. Its better side, how about its best side? Oh, let's see, they do this in conjunction with amassing a collection of a merit for how long? 100 great aeons, and so forth. And then the so forth means, I guess, the collection of wisdom. There's the two collections, merit and wisdom. And then in one, the significance is that in this tradition, the Pratyeka Buddhists collect merit for only 100 great aeons, whereas bodhisattvas collect merit for three incalculable aeons, which is each incalculable aeon is like 1,000 great aeons or something ridiculous thing like that. And then in one sitting, in one meditation session, like just before dinner, they actualize the stages from the heat level of the path of preparation. So the path of preparation has four stages, beginning with heat, and through to and including the path of no more learning, the fifth path. Solitary realizers are those who have met with teachers and listened to their teaching of the doctrine in previous lives, but in their final life, live in the desire realm peacefully and by themselves like a rhinoceros. They do not meet with teachers or study doctrine in that life. Great vehicle tenet systems. Mahayana tenet systems also assert another type of solitary realizers who do meet and study with the teacher early in their final lifetime, but then go off alone and achieve their goal. According to the Mahavibhasha school, solitary realizers, Pratyeka Buddhists, have an accumulated merit for 100 great aeons over the path accumulation, pass in one meditative sitting through the four levels of the path of preparation, heat, peak, forbearance, and supreme mundane qualities, these weird names, and then the path of seeing, meditation, and no more learning. All that in one path. That's what Buddha Shakyamuni, they hold, did all in that in one sitting. Furthermore, proponents of the Great Exposition assert the existence of types of arhats who degenerate. Degenerate arhats. I want to be. I don't want to be a degenerate arhat. Because there are lesser vehicle, Hinayana arhats, who fall from their abandonment of the obstructions and their realizations of the fall of the four truths, whereupon they become mere stream enterers again. Presumably this was something that happened to arhats, and so they had to accept it and somehow account for it. Here we don't have the accounting of it, we just have the acknowledgement of it. There's five types of fallible foe destroyers, and a sixth type who is not capable of degeneration. Only the sixth type would be considered an actual arhat by other schools. With respect to here, they enumerate a presentation of the 20 members of the spiritual community, Sangha. There's this famous list of 20 members of the Sangha. It's like there's different levels of monkness. There's like a trainee, there's an apprentice, or the lower level of a monk, and then a final level of monk. There's, I think, four levels of monks, and there's two types of gendered human beings in this system only. It's a binary system, so it's there's two, four of each is eight, and then I think they add the four stages of stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and arhat, something like that. And somehow they come up with 20. You can find that list if you're interested. It's not that helpful. However, along with the eight approachers and abiders, the eight approachers and abiders are of the 16 moments of the path of seeing. However, they do not assert that anyone simultaneously abandons the afflictive emotions all at once. 20 members of the spiritual community represent a classification, a location, a number of lives remaining for practitioners on the way to attaining the fruits of stream entry. Once returner, non-returner, and foe destroyer, arhat. The eight approachers and abiders are beings who are approaching to or abiding in the fruits of stream entry. Once returner and non-returner and arhat, the four abiders refer to persons who have fully accomplished or who abide in these fruits. So each of the four stages of arhatship, stream enter all the way to arhatship, or accomplishment in this tradition, since they're not all arhats, sorry. Each of them has the stage of abider and approacher. Is that what they say? Let's see. Approaching to or abiding in. So you have four stages, and you have two sort of aspects of each stage. You approach that stage, and then you accomplish it, and you abide in it. So there's those eight stages. And the four abiders refer to persons who have fully accomplished or abide in these fruits. Stream enterers never will, who never will never again be reborn, is one who will never be born as in the lower realms, hell, hungry ghost, animal. Once returner will be reborn once more in the desire realm, and never a returner will never be born again in the desire realm. And a foe destroyer has overcome the afflictive emotions, and is thus completely liberated from cyclic existence, which is divided into three realms and nine levels. The first level is the desire realm. The next four levels are the four divisions of the form realm, called the four concentrations. The last four levels are divisions of the formless realm. Each level has nine series of obstacles that are to be abandoned: big, middle, or middle big, small big, middle, and small middle, and big small, middle small, and small. So you see on the chart on the next page, you have the realm and the level, starting from the bottom: desire, form, formless. And you have the four absorptions, first, second, third, fourth. And then you have the four formless realms, the infinities of space, consciousness, nothingness, and the peak of cyclic existence. And then you have afflictions. In desire realm, you have nine of them. And then you have the rest of the 72 that occur over the form and formless realms. And then the aspect of the path: uninterrupted release, uninterrupted release, uninterrupted release. And then you have the enter and abider and stream enter, once returner, never, and arhat. Next page, 214. Simultaneous abandonment refers to the simultaneous overcoming and abandoning of, for example, each of the big of the nine levels. Thus, one who passes through the path of meditation with simultaneous abandonment has only nine steps to accomplish instead of 81. The proponents of the great exposition do not accept any such simultaneous abandonment, implying that the Mahayana does, or maybe the Sautrantika. They maintain that the eight types of approachers and abiders are all superiors, meaning path of seeing above. This means that even approachers to the fruit of stream enter have entered the path of seeing, from which point they're no longer ordinary beings but superiors. Other systems maintain that an approacher to the fruit of stream entry is on the path of reparation. So I'm going to join the the Vaibhashika system, so that you get onto the path of seeing more quickly. Bodhisattvas such as Shakyamuni complete their collections of merit and wisdom over three periods of countless great aeons during the path of accumulation. Having done this, they achieve the causes of the excellent marks of a Buddha over 100 aeons, and then in their final life, vanquish the array of demons at twilight while seated beside the tree of enlightenment, the Bodhi tree. At midnight, first at twilight, they overcome the Maras. At midnight, while in meditative equipoise, they actualize the three paths of preparation, seeing, and meditation. Later, just prior to dawn, they actualize the path of no more learning and become a Buddha. Therefore, from among the 12 deeds of a Buddha, they consider that the taming of the demons at twilight and the preceding deeds that happened leading up to that are performed when the Buddha was a common person, and that the three bodhisattva paths of preparation, seeing, meditation are all only meditative equipoise because they occur only during meditative sitting. Out of the 12 deeds of the Buddha, the famous list of 12 deeds of a Buddha, only the first nine are asserted to be the deeds of a bodhisattva, and the last three are asserted to be the deeds of a Buddha. In case we're wondering at that quandary of like which one of those 12 is performed by an ordinary being and which by a Buddha. So keep you up at night. 12 deeds are descent from the joyous Pure Land to Shita. And the second one is conception. Now, conception is when he entered the womb, right? So there's a little significance nuance here that they don't really explain clearly, but the Buddha first abides in a pure land. In there's two types of Tushita or Akanishta, and one of them is a Buddha land, and the 10th stage Bodhisattva sits there. And when they decide to take birth, then they take birth into the God realm named Akanishta. And then from there, they then enter the womb of their mother upon conception. So it's a two-step journey. First, they have to enter into the realms of samsara. Proponents of the Great Exposition assert that a wheel of doctrine is necessarily a path of seeing, and that a verbal wheel of doctrine is necessarily a wheel of doctrine of the four truths, which is a sort of bizarre and obscure and weird statement that we don't need to talk about further. The proponents of the Great Exposition assert that the seven treatises, manifest knowledge, otherwise known as the seven Abhidhamma texts, were spoken by the Buddha and written down by arhats. So they are attributed to the Buddha. They say that Buddha's word is always literal in terms of literal and provisional, or definitive and provisional. They use the term literal and interpretive, that there's two types of teachings which are literal and teachings which are interpretive, and that the Buddha was always blatantly literal, completely literal. Apart from the 80,000 bundles of doctrine, they do not assert a presentation of 84,000 bundles of doctrine. So they quibble over there. There's like a four bundles of doctrine. And a bundle of doctrine is like a stalks of hay tied together by string. They have this weird conception that the Dharma comes in bundles based upon the afflictions. There's 21,000 for each of the root afflictions, and then 21,000 for all of them together, totaling 84,000 in one tradition. However, this one has 80,000. Vasubandhu says the 80,000 bundles were spoken by the subduer, which is another epithet of the Buddha. The doctrine is arranged into bundles like wheat that's been cut and bound at harvest time. The bundle signifies the teaching of variable length, which variable meaning. It can be any length, which if thoroughly realized, capable of overcoming one affliction. So there's 80,000 afflictions, and you can overcome them one by one, bundle by bundle. Those schools asserting 84,000 bundles say that there are 21,000 for each of the three afflictive emotions and a fourth for all three together. You know, it's amazing. This is like Christianity, you know, getting into like having the angels on a head of a pin. These weird little differences of opinion become like formalized as part of their tenet systems. Place where bodhisattvas actualize. Yes, sir, ma'am.
I just had a question. This is sort of going back to when you were saying that they treat everything as literal, and that therefore everything is all of Buddha word is literal, definitive, no provisional. So how do they not run, are there not, how do they deal with contradictions within the Buddha word? Do they
Don't find any contradictions.
They didn't find any. And is it because they don't, that they reject some of the teachings that others?
Well, they don't accept any Mahayana sutras. And when we speak from our tradition's point of view of there being three turnings of the wheel of the Dharma, it's really the second and third that contradict the first.
Right. So is it actually true that there's no contradictions within the first?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't think anybody has done an exhaustive analysis of that. It would be neat if somebody did. Like in Christianity, you know, they compare. It's so much easier. They have these four versions of the same thing, the life of Jesus, mostly his crucifixion and rising up, whatever you call that. But you can compare those quite easily. Like, they contain all these details, like when did Jesus come to Jerusalem? How long before he was crucified? What did he eat? What did he wear? What did they say? You know, that sort of stuff. And you can compare between the four testaments of the New Testament. And in the Buddhist sutras, there's like numerous versions of similar sutras. And I don't think, I don't know, there's very few, there's a couple of studies that I haven't seen where they like compare the same sutra, the same scene in different sutras. But, you know, they don't go down to the detail that would be needed, really. It's really the teachings, you know, in one version he gives the long, like the Satipatthana Sutra, there's three versions of that, and one of them is very long, and he goes through all these different details that one does in each of the four mindfulnesses, and in other versions it's summarized. So
and since I understand they only go with the first turning, not the second, third. So does that mean like whatever he said at Vulture Peak Mountain from their point of view didn't happen?
Well, I think Vulture Peak Mountain was a common place he taught from, and from their point of view he taught, you know, like Four Noble Truths stuff. But they don't accept any of the Mahayana Vajrayana teachings,
right.
Sutras,
okay.
And tantras.
And so that's where most of the contradiction comes in, and nobody knows for sure that there's nothing in the first turning that contradicts. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, like the main thing is in the second turning, he says everything's empty. There is no self. There is no eye, no ear, no nose. And that contradicts what he says over and over again in the first turning, where he says, they're the aggregates. There's the aggregate of form and feeling and perception. So to say there is no form, feeling, and perception, if you understood that literally, would be a contradiction. So the later tradition says, well, the scheme is not literal versus interpretive. The scheme is provisional versus definitive. The teaching of the aggregates is a provisional teaching to lead one up to a certain point, and then you introduce the definitive understanding, which is they don't really exist as self-sufficient.
Right, but these guys don't buy that approach.
That's right. As being sufficiently established as self-sufficient, something like that, right? Something established. I love that phrase. I got to get that phrase down.
The Christians have an easy answer for that, for the Gospels. They just eliminated the Gospels they didn't agree with, and they, I don't know, in the first, it was maybe
with Constantinople.
Yeah, well, yeah.
He got rid of incarnation, reincarnation, all sorts of fun things. Anyway, we're running out of time.
There were a couple other gospels that were just
ejected. Yeah, we tossed them.
That's it. They just pretended like they never existed and outlawed their...
yeah, that's sort of like what the earlier traditions did with the Mahayana sutras. It's like no dice. The place where the bodhisattvas actualize enlightenment during their last lifetime is definitely just the desire realm. Therefore, the proponents of great exposition do not assert a presentation of a heavenly adorned, highest, pure land, Akanishta Ganavyuha, or Sambhogakaya, enjoyment body. So the implication that they're saying indirectly is that in the Mahayana tradition, the Buddha actually achieves enlightenment not on earth, under the Bodhi tree, but in his psychic subtle body, he attains enlightenment in Akanishta Ganavyuha, in a Buddha, in a pure land. All the Buddhas of the 10 directions come and give him Abhisheka and anoint him as a Buddha. That's how he achieves Buddhahood. According to the Great Vehicle System, the highest pure land is where an immortal, I love that they say immortal, an immortal enlightened enjoyment body, Sambhogakaya, resides and preaches the great vehicle path of bodhisattvas and the path of seeing and above. So the Sambhogakaya Buddha is always there teaching, you know, the five certainties, the perfect teaching, time, place, retinue, or audience, and teacher. Ordinary beings are not allowed in this type of pure land. Although they do exist in the pure lands of emanation bodies, nirmanakaya, such as Sukhavati, Shambhala, things like that. Most Mahayana systems also hold that bodhisattvas attain full enlightenment in the highest pure land. Not only this, but they also don't accept omniscience because they only assert all knowingness, as mentioned above. All arhats of the three vehicles have a nirvana with remainder because they assert that when one attains a nirvana without remainder, there is a severing of the continuum of consciousness, like the extinction of a flame. So this is talking about achieving arhatship while you're still alive versus when you die. When you die, you achieve nirvana without remainder because you've severed the continuum of consciousness, like the extinction of a flame. However, when you achieve arhatship while you're still alive, there's remainder of the continuum of the aggregates and all that that entails in terms of hunger and exposure to reactions to heat and pain and so forth, thirst, so forth. Some propound that the teacher merely withdrew a creation of his body from the sight of certain trainees when he passed from suffering, i.e. enter parinirvana, that is, at the time of his death, and did not actually pass from suffering or completely vanish. So Cynthia just read the example. It's hilarious. But this is saying, like, they're talking about the Mahayana tradition that says, well, the Buddha didn't actually leave and cease, you know, he's taken a vow to constantly help all sentient beings until the end of samsara. So he's still around. He just withdrew his emanation body from this realm. And he's now doing the work, the good work in other places, in other ways. The commentary says, fish and turnips are both long and white, but they're very different things. For this reason, they're used metaphorically to indicate an absurd state of confusion. To confuse them for each other is absurd. The author appears to hold that it is inconsistent for proponents of a system that asserts a complete severance of the continuum of consciousness in a nirvana without a remainder to assert that such did not actually happen upon Shakyamuni Buddha's death. Jamyashepa speaks of just an assertion as being reported by a transmission stemming from Atisha. So it's like, who said this about who, what, whom? So we can skip all that. And we should. So next page, 218, first nod, indented paragraph, Buddha superiors. Buddha superiors. Wow. Have abandoned all sufferings. What is Buddha superior as compared to a Buddha? That's weird. Have abandoned all sufferings in their origins without exception, yet it is not contradictory that true suffering still exists within their continuum. That's why it's with remainder. This is because when all afflictive emotions that take true sufferings as their objects are abandoned, this is posited as the abandonment of true sufferings, which is, as explained in the indented section, is a really bizarre and convoluted and unclear way of saying that even though the potential for suffering exists in their continuum, they don't result in any afflictions arising within their continuum. They do not give rise to afflictive emotions. Next, the Buddha's physical body is included in the same lifetime as the physical base of a bodhisattva on the path of preparation. What? What does that mean? So they assert that this body is not a Buddha jewel. So a Buddha's physical body is in the same lifetime as when they were an ordinary Joe. And so therefore, the Buddha's body, physical body, because it was still subject to suffering and heat and cold and pains and aches, is not the true Buddha jewel that we take refuge in. We take refuge in the Dharmakaya, not the Nirmanakaya. And so thus they assert that the body is not a Buddha jewel, although it is a Buddha, which is sort of absurd. But
so this is from the Vaibhashika point of view, you're saying?
That's correct, from the
Vaibhashika. They actually believe in the Dharmakaya stuff?
They have Dharmakaya, but they don't have Sambhogakaya.
Oh, okay.
And this whole thing about the body and the body of a Buddha is not the Buddha jewel, but it is the body of a Buddha, sort of like cutting hairs, right? That was a joke since they shave their hair. But anyway, in this system, bodhisattvas are said to pass from the path of preparation to the path of no more learning, 2 to 4, 5, rather, in one meditative sitting. Therefore, when they achieve Buddhahood, they do so in their same body, which they, as bodhisattvas, began the path of preparation. Anybody in advance of the path of seeing is just an ordinary sentient being. Since it's still an ordinary body, it cannot be an immaculate Buddha jewel. Many scholars also say that a Buddha's body is not a Buddha because it is a true suffering because it experiences suffering as any body does. From their point of view, the Buddha jewel is asserted to be the wisdom of extinction of the obstructions and the wisdom that the obstructions will never be produced again, which exist in the mental continuum of a Buddha. So the actual Buddha jewel, different from the body of a Buddha, is asserted to have these two wisdoms, the wisdom that the obstructions have been extinguished and the wisdom that they will never be produced again. And those two do exist in the continuum of a Buddha, but when one takes refuge by Zen, the Buddha jewel, one bows not to the Buddha's body, but to the Buddha's wisdom. With regard to wisdoms, the generate type of foe destroyer attain only the wisdom of extinction of afflictive emotions. They do not attain the wisdom of the future non-production because they fall. Similarly, because learner superiors, those on the path of seeing and meditation. I see superior. Buddha superiors is a bizarre term. Learner superiors makes more sense because you can have learners that span from paths 1 to 4. Paths of accumulation, preparation, seeing, and meditation are paths of learning compared to the fifth path, which is called the path of no more learning. Because learner superiors, meaning the paths of seeing and meditation, are beings who have contamination. They are not considered to be the Sangha jewel, although they are members of the Sangha spiritual community. It is the same thing with the Buddha jewel. It's the true paths in the mental continuum of a learner superior which are asserted to be the community jewel. It's the true paths in the mental continuum. It's this bizarre way of conceptualizing that the paths exist in the continuum of a being, like it's some entity in their mind stream or something weird. And that's the true Sangha jewel there. Also is a presentation of the doctrine jewel, because nirvanas and true cessations and the continuums of the three travelers are all doctrine dharma jewels. Weird stuff. You know, it was like, is the word of the Buddha not associated formation or not. A nirvana refers to the true cessation of all afflictive emotions, whereas true cessation can be a cessation of any affliction, such as only one of the 81 abandonments on the path of meditation. Let's see. And that was it. So now we go to the presentation in the Yoga Svatantrika tradition, which begins on page 288. So we're in the Mahayana school. We're in a Prasangika, we're in a Madhyamaka school from among the two Mahayana schools, which are Chittamatra and Madhyamaka. And we're in the Svatantrika, autonomous syllogism school. And we're in the yogic version of that, the Yoga Svatantrika, as opposed to the Sautrantrika Svatantrika, the sutras. Svatantrika, assertions on the path, page 288. Three parts, objects of observation of the path, objects abandoned, and the nature. Objects of observation, the yogic autonomists. Assert that a person's emptiness of being permanent, unitary, and independent is a coarse selflessness of persons. So now in the Madhyamaka, we get into these gradations of the selflessnesses of both persons. Well, of persons, not phenomena. They assert that a person's emptiness of being substantially existent in the sense of being self-sufficient is a subtle selflessness of persons, as opposed to the coarse one is the three aspects that we always talk about is the easiest for people to get a handle on what a self is. It's being permanent or continuous, unitary, and independent. And because that's the more understandable. So that's the coarse level of the self of a person. And a subtle level of a self of a person is that which is substantially existent in the sense of being self-sufficient, meaning what I described earlier as being independent of its basis of designation. The coarse selflessness of persons is also applicable to phenomena in the sense that all phenomena are empty of being objects of use of a permanent, unitary, and independent user. The subtle selflessness of persons, so there is a coarse selflessness of persons is also applicable to phenomena in the sense that all phenomena are empty of being objects of use. So in this system, we have a coarse and a subtle selflessness of phenomena as well. The subtle selflessness of persons similarly applies to phenomena, in that all phenomena are empty of being objects that are used by a substantially existent or self-sufficient user. So we have these two levels of gradation of both selflessness of persons and phenomena. Thereby it is seen that, according to the autonomous, the base of the emptiness of persons is not just the person, but all phenomena also. So the base of the emptiness of persons is not just the person, but also all phenomena. It's a funny phrase, but the basis of a person is the phenomena of the aggregates, which is what they're saying. Also, the bases of the emptiness of phenomena are not just phenomena excluding the person, but also the person, which is a non-associated phenomena. Thus, the bases of the two emptiness are the same. However, the object negated in, for instance, the subtle selflessness of persons is substantial existence, whereas the object negated in the subtle selflessness of phenomena is true existence. Different words for a similar thing, a different way of referring to something that doesn't exist. In terms of a person, we talk about the substantial existence in the sense of being self-sufficient, whereas in terms of phenomena, we talk about true existence in the sense of being inherently existent. So, not really that phenomenally earth-shattering, but two different ways of looking at two different bases of emptiness. Thus, for the autonomists, the bases of the emptiness of a self of persons and the bases of the emptiness of a self of phenomena are the same, but the object negated, so the bases are the same, In both cases, it's the aggregates. But the object of negation is different. That of which the bases are empty is different. Base of emptiness here means an object that is empty of a negated element. It should not be understood as a physical base out of which phenomena are produced. Still, it can be said that emptiness is the base of all phenomena because if phenomena were not empty of true existence, they could not be produced or destroyed. If they were not empty, they couldn't be independently arising. Yogic autonomists assert that forms, being one of the skandhas, a form's emptiness of being an entity other than the prime cognition apprehending the form, is a core selflessness of phenomena. So this idea that a phenomena exists independent of the cognition of that phenomena. So independent of the base, the independent of the projection onto that base, i.e. from its own side. That way of existing from its own side is a coarse selflessness of phenomena. They assert that the emptiness of true existence of all phenomena is the subtle selflessness of phenomena. So those two gradations in phenomena, similar to the two gradations in persons, is this tongue twister subtle difference that requires like a lot of explanation to unpack, which we don't have here at the moment. Objects abandoned by the past. The yogic autonomists assert that consciousness is conceiving the coarse and subtle versions of itself of persons, are the obstructions to liberation from samsara, and they assert that consciousness is conceiving the coarse and subtle versions of itself of phenomena, the obstructions to omniscience. So attachment to self is the cause of samsara, and attachment to phenomena is the cause of non-omniscience. There are two types of obstructions to omniscience. They assert that a consciousness conceiving an otherness of substantial entity of apprehended object and apprehended subject is a coarse obstruction to omniscience. So the notion of duality, of there being a difference between subject and object, is the coarse level of self of phenomena. Or true, and the subtle version, a consciousness conceiving the true existence of phenomena such as the mental physical aggregates, is a subtle obstruction to omniscience. So one is the first level, the coarse level, is just that subject and object are separate substantial entities, and then the subtle is the true existence. And true existence, they try to distinguish true existence from established in the sense of being self-sufficient. My mind is like a sieve. I can't remember this phrase. Anyway, so those are the two levels. Self, substantially existent in the sense of being self-sufficient is one level. And is the coarse level of a self of persons, and then they just described it. How did they describe it? I'm sorry. So on page before 288, the coarse level of persons is being permanent, unitary, and independent, and the subtle selflessness of persons is self-sufficient, substantially existent in the sense of being self-sufficient. And in terms of phenomena, it's the coarse level is the otherness of subject and object, duality, and the coarse level, and the subtle level is true existence, which they distinguish from substantially existent in the sense of being self-sufficient. So self-substantially existent in the sense of being self-existent is something that exists separate from its basis of imputation, such as the aggregates. And true existence is something that exists inexplicably or ineffably or sort of beyond conception sort of thing. I can't remember the formal explanation, definition. Nature of the paths. They serve five paths of the three vehicles, making 15 just of the other systems. The difference is in their assertion that an uninterrupted path, the path of release of a Pratyeka Buddha, must have the aspect of realizing an emptiness of duality. So in that weird sentence, they're saying that they're saying that Pratyeka Buddhas understand the first, what we would call the first half of the self of phenomena, selflessness of phenomena. Whereas in the Vaibhashika presentation, they don't accept the selflessness of phenomena. They say phenomena are real. But in the Mahayana, in the Madhyamaka tradition, they say that Pratyeka Buddhas must, in order to become Buddhas, must understand at least the coarse level of selflessness of phenomena. An uninterrupted path is the meditative equipoise vanquishing the obstructions of that level. It leads directly without interruption to the attainment of a path of release, the experience of having vanquished those obstructions. So it's very similar to the schema of having a forbearance and then a knowledge in terms of the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, or the 16 moments, rather, of the path of seeing. Let's see, emptiness of duality here refers to subject and objects, emptiness of being different entities. The aspect of a path is its mode of apprehension. A path is a consciousness which, when actualized, will lead one to high attainments. So when they talk about true paths being present in the continuum of a superior, a path is the moment, is a mode of apprehension, and it's a consciousness. A path is a consciousness. You thought a path was like a physical thing that you walked on, but a path is a consciousness in this scheme. Assertions of the fruits. Pratyeka Buddhas take as their main object of abandonment the coarse obstructions to omniscience, the conception that subject to object are different entities. Therefore, the presentation of the eight approaches and abiders is not applicable to solitary realizers, Pratyeka Buddhas. Because Pratyeka Buddhas strive mainly to abandon the coarse obstructions to omniscience, the eight approachers and abiders that we saw in the scheme of the 16 moments, which deal with abandoning the obstructions to liberation, do not apply to them. I don't know. That's an odd statement. However, the approaches and abiders are asserted with respect to the Shravakas, because they don't understand the first part of the selflessness of phenomena. Those firm in the Shravaka lineage take as their main object of meditative cultivation the view realizing the selflessness of persons. Skipping the indent. Finally, independence on the body, like meditative stabilization of their path of meditation, they abandon all obstructions to liberation and simultaneously actualize the fruit of Shravaka Arhat. Those firm in the solitary and the Pratyeka Buddha lineage take as their main object of meditative cultivation the view that apprehending subject and apprehended object are empty of duality. Finally, independence of the Vajra-like meditative stabilization of their path of meditation, they entirely abandon the obstructions to liberation, as well as the coarse obstructions to omniscience, and simultaneously attain the fruit of Pratyeka Buddha Arhat, which is an odd phrase, Pratyeka Buddha Arhat. Sometimes you see the phrase Buddha Arhat. Lesser vehicle nirvanas are of two types. So Hinayana nirvanas are of two types, remainder and without. Those with remainder, those without remainder. The first is a nirvana having the remainder of miserable mental and physical aggregates that were wrought by former contaminated actions, afflicted emotions. The second type is asserted to be a state devoid of miserable and mental and physical aggregates. A hero, solitary, realizer, foe destroyer will necessarily enter the great vehicle because they assert only one final vehicle. Therefore, in this system, due to a difference in the objects of abandonment and the type of realization of here and realizers, there's also a distinction of inferiority and superiority with respect to the fruits that they attain. Those firm in the great vehicle lineage generate mind of altruistic aspiration to highest enlightenment, then during the great level of the path of accumulation. So this description of the Bodhisattva path. Those firm in Mahayana lineage generate a mind of bodhicitta, and during the great level of the path of accumulation, dependence on the meditative stabilization of the stream of doctrine, Shrotanugata Samadhi. So they have a samadhi, meditative stabilization, focused on the Dharma, the Dharma as a stream. What does that mean? Shrota, the hearing. The samadhi of hearing the Dharma. Huh? They actually listen to preceptual instructions from supreme emanation bodies, supreme mnemonikayas. Wow, or maybe that's Samboga gods. When, now that would be in Nirmanakas. When, in dependence on their practicing the meaning of these instructions, they first produce the wisdom arisen from meditation, which observes emptiness, they pass on to the path of preparation. So in the Mahayana tradition, the definition of the transition from the first path of accumulation to the second path of preparation is the production of wisdom arisen from meditation, which observes emptiness. So there's wisdom from hearing, there's wisdom from contemplating, and there's wisdom from meditating, and wisdom from meditating, which observes emptiness. And the footnote, let's see, it just says Bhavanamai is prajna, based on mental cultivation as opposed to contemplation, based on meditative training. Then at the time of heat, which is the first of the four levels of the path of preparation, the manifest conception of thoroughly afflicted objects as truly existent objects of use diminishes. So they still have the manifest conception of thoroughly afflicted objects, which manifest is as opposed to something else. There's a significance to that term. Let's see if they explain it. An example of this is the apprehension of a cup as an object of use, i.e. drinking, that truly exists. That only the manifest conception of this diminishes indicates that the seeds of these obstructions are not abandoned at this point. Thus, the obstructions still exist latently. So that's the nuance, is that the fully ripened seeds of viewing of the manifest, of the conception of thoroughly afflicted objects, which include cups. We're not talking about the afflictions like the kleshas. We're talking about objects that are seen as truly existent because of our being thoroughly afflicted. Thus, these obstructions still exist latently at the time of attaining peak, because we have not uprooted them. We've sort of glimpsed a separate reality, but not yet uprooted the belief in the current reality. At the time of attaining peak, the second level of the path of preparation, the manifest conception of pure objects, such as true cessations and true paths, as truly existent objects of use, diminishes. That is an odd statement that I'm going to not even try to unpack. When for parents, the third level of the path of corruption is attained, the manifest conception of a truly existent user with regard to a subject, i.e. consciousness, that apprehends objects as substantially existent, diminishes. So in the third level, the manifest conception of the apprehender, the subject, diminishes. So first the object diminishes, the belief in the object as being existent from its own side, and then the belief in the subject as existent on its own self-sufficient basis diminishes. When highest mundane qualities, the fourth and last level of the path of preparation, is attained, the manifest conception of a truly existent user with regard to a subject, i.e. consciousness, that apprehends objects as imputed, diminishes. So the difference is the apprehension of objects as substantially existent or as imputed, i.e. imputed being. So substantially existent is the coarse level of selflessness of phenomena, and then imputed is the subtle level of selflessness of phenomena, i.e. the inherently existent. These four conceptions are abandoned by the path of seeing. So these four conceptions are very hard to track down. But the idea is that in the path of preparation, through the four stages of Pete, Heek, highest mundane qualities, and Peak, and supreme worldly Dharma, one overcomes these four conceptions. And vaguely, it seems to be the subtle, the coarse and subtle conception of a self of persons, and the coarse and subtle conception of a self of phenomena. But it's very hard to come up with explanations of these. If you ever run across any, let me know. And these four conceptions are then completely abandoned on the path of seeing. They're only sort of dampened by the path of, they're diminished, it says, on the path of preparation. The four stages, heat, peak, forbearance, and highest mundane qualities, that's the, I screwed up the third one, are respectively called the meditative stabilization of achieving perception of emptiness. So the nuance is that the first path culminates in the achievement of a samadhi in the sense of a shamatha samadhi. On the stream of doctrine, a shamatha samadhi that's sort of focused on the meeting of all dharmas coming to one point, as in the slogan, all dharmas meet in one point, agree at one point, and that point is selflessness. And then the second path culminates in a meditative stabilization of vipassana, which is the perception of emptiness, the meditative stabilization of the increase of the perception of emptiness, the meditative stabilization which understands suchness one-sidedly, and the uninterrupted meditative stabilization are respectively called. So there's four meditative stabilizations that occur on this path, and four stages of vipassana. Meditative stabilization, so perception of emptiness, increase of the perception of emptiness, understand suchness, and uninterrupted meditative stabilization, which is not descriptive of its content. The meditative stabilization, which understands suchness one-sidedly, is so called because of the, for the first time, yogis have attained clear conceptual perception. We're in path of preparation still. Clear conceptual perception of the emptiness of objects, but have not yet gained such perception of the emptiness of subjects. So that's in the first two segments of the path of preparation. Thus, their concentration is one-sided with respect to emptiness. The uninterrupted concentration is so called because in the same session, yoga will proceed without interruption to a path of release, of a path of seeing. So they're on their way. And so the significance is that first we overcome the selflessness of a person, and then we overcome the self, the belief in self, of phenomena as a separate object, and then we overcome the belief in the self of phenomena of the person, which is confusing because it sounds like we've gone back to the self of persons, but it's really the phenomena of persons, of the subject, phenomena of the subject. And that's the second fold of the twofold egolessness that Trungpa Rinpoche aptly describes as the arrogance of thinking, of having the thought that we've overcome the obstructions, or that we've experienced emptiness. Right after that, the acquired obstructions to liberation. So there's acquired and innate obstructions, and the acquired ones are acquired over the lifetime or lifetimes of ascension beings, whereas the innate ones are unchanged from life to life of ascension being until uprooted in full enlightenment, and are born in all sentient beings regardless of education, regardless of type of sentient being. Worms up to gadflies all have innate ignorance, but they acquire different types of obstructions. And the acquired obstructions to omniscience, so those two types of obstructions both have an acquired and innate flavor, together with their seeds, being the innate, are removed by an uninterrupted path of the path of seeing. A path of release of the path of seeing and a true cessation of the acquired obstructions are then actualized, which is a really bizarre, clunky way of saying that on the path of seeing, one achieves, uproots the obstructions to liberation and partially to omniscience. Acquired obstructions to liberation refer to superimpositions of self of persons that are not inborn but intellectually acquired. Such conviction is gained through teachings and proofs of, for instance, a substantially existent self-sufficient person. Acquired obstructions to omniscience refer to superimpositions of a self of phenomena that derive from conviction gained through the teachings and proofs of a difference of entity of subject and object, or of true existence. The path of release here is the state of having vanquished the acquired obstructions. True cessation here is the state of cessation completely forever of the acquired obstructions. Said that through the nine steps of the path of meditation, each of which has a greater, small, medium, and small, making 81, the seeds of the 16 afflictive emotions and the seeds of the 108 obstructions to omniscience, which are to be abandoned by the path of meditation, are gradually abandoned. And finally, in dependence on the uninterrupted path at the end of the continuum of existence of ascension being, the highest peak of existence in the path of preparation, the innate afflictive emotions and the innate obstructions to omniscience. I'm sorry, that's at the end of the path of learning, which is the path of meditation, the fourth path. The innate afflictions to both afflictive emotions and obstructions to omniscience, i.e. liberation omniscience, are both simultaneously abandoned, and in the next moment, highest enlightenment is attained. Upon the attainment of Buddhahood, one is no longer a sentient being, but this does not mean that a Buddha has no mind. The term sentient being specifically refers to a being who has obstructions yet to be overcome, and thus a Buddha does not have obstructions yet to be abandoned, but is not a sentient being. The innate obstructions are the conscious, which is very different than the way we use the term sentient being. We mean sentient being as somebody who's sentient, but for the Buddhist tradition, it specifically means someone who's not a Buddha, basically. The innate obstructions are the consciousnesses conceiving a self persons and a self of phenomena that derive from the beginningless habit of viewing persons and phenomena as, for instance, truly existent. The term, for instance, implies that there's other ways of incorrectly viewing them, such as substantially existent or inherently existent. The term innate or inborn means that these obstructions are produced along with the mental and physical aggregates without the need of conviction gained through teachings and proofs, which is a clunky, you know, this idea that we acquired ignorance is through teachings and proofs is sort of antiquated view. It's basically we acquire the acquired obstructions by the people around us and the customs and the norms and the realities of the life that we're born in. Like, and it's not like we have to be convinced of them by proof. The proof is like apples fall to the ground, gravity, you know, there's gravity, things like that. This is the way that fruit is manifested by those who affirm the Bodhisattva lineage. They assert that a great vehicle, Nirvana, Mahayana, Nirvana, and a non-abiding Nirvana are mutually inclusive. So in the Mahayana, Nirvana is non-abiding Nirvana, and we don't have this distinction of with and without remainder. In a non-abiding Nirvana, due to wisdom, there is no abiding cyclic existence, and due to compassion, there is no abiding in solitary peace. They assert that the number of bodies of a Buddha is definitely four. Even though Arya Vimukta Sen and Haribhadra debated about the teachings regarding the bodies of a Buddha, they did not debate about the number being limited to four. There's the qualities, I guess. Four bodies of a Buddha are nature bodies, swabhavika body, wisdom body, dharmakaya, complete enjoyment, sambhogakaya, emanation, nirmanakaya. With respect to the word of Buddha, a presentation of definitive sutras and sutras requiring interpretation is made. For sutras requiring interpretation are those that teach within taking conventional truths as the main object of their explicit teachings, and definitive sutras are those that teach within taking ultimate truths as the main object of their explicit teachings. So we have this sort of matrix here of interpretive and definitive and explicit and inexplicit. That nuance was thrown in there, the explicit part, right? For scripture to be definitive, it also must be literally acceptable without qualification. For instance, even a passage teaching that all phenomena are empty of inherent existence requires interpretation. Though the main object taught is an ultimate truth, the passage cannot be accepted without the qualification. Ultimately, that is, all phenomena are ultimately empty of inherent existence with respect to the wheels of doctrine explained in the sutra. Unraveling the thought, the third turning sutra, the first wheel requires interpretation. The last two wheels are both asserted to have two types, definitive and require interpretation. That's a very interesting statement coming from the Gulukbos. And that concludes. There's no need to go through Sutra Autonomy Middleway Schools, Sao Trantika Swatantika Schools, the assertions on the basis, the assertions of the path. So if you just skim that briefly, their views of the paths are more akin to the Sao Trantika tradition than the Madhyamaka tradition. So they're treated in a very curt, short way. The only interesting point is at the bottom of page 298.
We don't have that part, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay, our stops at the beginning of that next section, 297, I think. It's what mine does anyway.
Yep. Very good. Then we'll call it a wrap. We'll call it a wrap at that. Conclude with any, New Year's resolutions, anyone?
Let's get through dun season before we start making resolutions, huh?
Great idea. Yeah, we didn't do the Mamo chant. I set the chant so you can do it on your own. Should we do it once together to conclude? Mamos? Where do we have the Mamos? Pacifying the Mamos. Yo, I think of the revival energy, dark age, when the sacred mudra is straightened up, and when someone's children don't listen to their parents' words in the old town, when relatives quarrel, people just sloveling clothes and rags, eating bad cheap food, when there are family feuds and civil wars, these provoke the black mama's wrath, these various demons fill a thousand realms, sending sickness upon humans and beasts, the skies thick with purple clouds of sickness, they incite cosmic warfare. They destroy because in the age of weaponry, they suddenly strike people who evade all serious swords completely daring. They bring down hail and thunderbirds, earth lords, nogs, and yens, your subjects. The eight classes, devas, rakshasas, and so on, your retinue. There's nothing you cannot subject, and whatever sickness comes from your mamas, whatever plague there is comes from your mamas, whatever blood there is comes from your mamas, please change the course of evil and sickness, and we make this offering so you may be appeased. By this, my sentences of turmoil, what he did in the office of redemption, takes appeasement, brags and materials. May the turmoil of the mamas be pacified, be appeased, Samaya. Through the blessings of appeasing your first yogams that are the summons, may sickness. The cease and plague be averted, races from your charter doom, put away your dice. Please avert sickness, stones, and obstacles. Please avert evil prophecies and bad omens. May the misfortunes of the Amars be banished to the right. May the misfortunes of the Shemars be banished to the left. May the misfortunes of all Mars be banished into space. Now is the time of great exorcism. Now is the time, Samaya. Please perform the activities we request of you. Overcome ignorance from beginningless time, clouded by stupidity. The ladies in us have rooted straight from the path of omniscience. May the host of emanation, Darkness, forgive us. Om Samaya Samaya Om Samaya Trag Raksha Kamaja Gajatin Yang Krang Mabio Ja Om Bajasava Samaya Manabaya Pali Vajasava Tainta Batista Turada Mebo Sadisha Mebo Sapusha Mebo Narakta Mebo Sarasita Mebiacha Sara Kama Sutra Mejitim Shri Akuru Om Ha Bhagavan Sata Dagara Vajamami Mucha Vajri Bhava Maha Samaya Satua. Thank you for the musical accompaniment, Cynthia, even though we couldn't hear it, but I got the point.
Came the thought that counts.
That's what they say in the Chittimatra tradition, the thought that counts. And the sound of the bell is terrible over Zoom. So thank you, everyone, for...
Did it not come out? Oh.
It comes out a little bit, but it's still, like, really sharp.
Oh, okay, because I have... But Gong usually comes out okay. I've got original sound from this thing.
Yeah, Gong is fine. Anyway, thank you for persevering on this very long, what is this, class 15 or something?
You sure you're going to let it end?
Yes, that's it. And next week we do Dun season, and then next year we'll stare at the light of the moon. We'll all go crazy howling at the moon. With some moonshine. That's what it should be. Moonshine. Moonshine of Mahamudra. Moonshine Shamata Vipassana. Anyway, by this merit may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the storm, it wears the birth, all the sickness and death from the ocean of samsara. May I free all beings by the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of radiance, wisdom, bloom, may the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled, may all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. So was the presentation of the paths just like you thought it might be?
This reading, you mean?
Well, we were going to go through the presentation of the paths, and this was one example of that. But I don't know, I thought it was sort of different than we might have thought the presentation of the paths would be like. But talk more about meditation, Shila, Samadhi, Prajna, that sort of thing. But anyway, I hope you all have a safe Dun season, and I look forward to seeing you again soon. And come visit Westchester Meditation Center, Alliance Center, on Losar Celebration Sunday, February 11th.
Oh, you're doing yours on Sunday also?
Yeah.
What time?
11 o'clock, we start with the sadhana of Mahamudra, and then we have a free lunch. How can you beat that? Come have some free lunch, and then we have thank yous and toasts and music and dancing, and we'll all go wild. just like it's 1999 or something like that. So please come visit us. See you then. Take care.
Bye. Thank you. Good night.